When you conjure up an idea of what strength looks like, would it be physical muscles you'd see? Here at Give Me Strength, we believe that strength doesn't look a certain way. For some, it may be the kilograms on their deadlift, but for others, it may be overcoming challenges that life can throw at us or developing a resilience through difficult experiences. My name is Alice Living. I'm a personal trainer, best-selling author, and influencer who knows only too well that strength is so much more than being just about the physical. And it's my mission now to use this podcast to inspire you with stories from people who've had to find courage through the most challenging or darkest of times, and who can help all of us to be inspired to be not just physically, but mentally stronger too. Welcome to Give Me Strength. It goes without saying that this podcast wouldn't be possible without the help of our sponsor, Pronamel Toothpaste. And before I introduce my guest, I wanted to give a shout out to them. Strength, both physically and mentally, are something we here at Give Me Strength are, of course, passionate about. And so we've teamed up with Pronamel to highlight the importance of also keeping strong and healthy enamel. Pronamel can help rebuild enamel strength that has been weakened by acidic food and drinks over time, and is therefore an ideal choice for strong and healthy teeth. With 77% of adults having some degree of enamel erosion in the UK, it's probably more common than you think and is the perfect reason to give your teeth a little extra TLC. And just as with both health and fitness, quick fixes are never the answer, and the same can be said for your teeth. With twice daily regular brushing, Pronamel can help rebuild enamel strength for strong, healthy, white teeth. Buy yours now from your retailer of choice by clicking the link in this episode's description or through your Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Home. To shop via Alexa, say, "Alexa, open Pronamel Toothpaste." To shop via Google Assistant or Home, say, "OK, Google, talk to Pronamel Toothpaste." Find out more in this episode's description. And now, on to today's show. As a personal trainer, I've had the pleasure of having the most colourful and eclectic mix of clients over the last few years. To me, being a coach doesn't involve barking exercises at someone on the gym floor until they're dripping with sweat. Instead, I take a more holistic approach, ensuring I cover not only my client's physical, but also mental well-being too. When working in close proximity to someone, it's natural for people to open up about experiences, good and bad. And I always joke that being a personal trainer is also being a part-time counselor too. My next guest is someone who I felt was not only a client, but also now a friend. And I am so excited to be joined by her today. Saran Jones came to me 2 years ago wanting to prepare for her exciting new role in the BBC One and HBO series Gentleman Jack. She was a new mum. She was also about to take up a role in a West End play. And it seemed to me as though she was juggling all of these challenges effortlessly. For those who might not be familiar with who Saran is, she is an English actor and producer who rose to fame as Carol McDonald in Coronation Street before going on to star in hugely successful TV dramas such as Unforgiven and Scott and Bailey. She then went on to receive a BAFTA award for Best Actress for her portrayal of Gemma Foster in the hit show Dr. Foster, which I'm sure many of you loved just as much as I did. And now she's joining me via the medium of the internet to hear how she went from Coronation Street to a much loved and celebrated star of stage and screen. Saran, how are you doing?
I'm in my wardrobe. Oh my goodness, Alice. I said to you, the only way I would do a podcast with you or with anyone is in bed in full pajamas, a cup of tea and biscuits, like Morecambe and Wise. And this is the total opposite.
I know. And I'm so sad as well, because we really pictured that idea of us both being in bed with tea and biscuits. What's your favorite biscuit, by the way?
Oh gosh, I would have brought like rich tea, nice biscuits, and then really big cookies, like Millie's like cookies. And we would have got it all over the bedding, and I would have been comfortable, because I've never done a podcast before. So I'm actually pretty nervous sat in my wardrobe in lockdown.
Don't be nervous, but welcome. And we're very, very excited to have you. This is a crazy time. It's unprecedented is the word that everyone's using, which it absolutely is. But we're almost four weeks in now. So do you feel like you're falling into a kind of routine now? You said you were making sock puppets this morning, which sounds very fun.
I overstretched myself this morning, I think. I think it's difficult. Like, and this is, you know, for any mum, I've got a 4-year-old, just 4, and he is beautiful and wonderful and creative and imaginative, and he wants to play constantly. So it's finding the balance between me being able to get my work done, my husband being able to get his work done, like, you know, like many parents, So yeah, this morning we went down to the woods to get our exercise. I had to be in full Minnie Mouse character the whole time. And then we made sock puppets and we made Marmite and cheese sausage rolls. So yeah, we need a routine. So we do like school work and arts and crafts, and I make sure that we do that Monday to Friday. And then on the weekend, we open a shop down the bottom of the garden that Mr. Monkey runs. He's one of our company toys. And my son goes and buys a comic off him at the weekend. So we're trying to differentiate, but it's weird. There are ups and downs, and there are still days where I just stop and cry, and I'm very overwhelmed by how long we'll be in this situation. But I think everyone's doing that, you know?
I was thinking, though, this must be such, like, for us adults, you can kind of, we understand, you know, as best as we can, the situation that's going on. But I always think, and I have been thinking, for children, it's just so unsettling because they don't quite really understand, and everything's all a bit up in the air, and mum and dad are both home, or, you know, everyone's around a lot more than they were. And it must be really strange, you know, to suddenly, you know, we were talking about how they're now not going to nursery and seeing their friends. That's just such a strange thing for them to try and get their head around. And I really feel for them.
And as well, I think that as humans, you know, 3-4 weeks in, we are starting to feel the loss of human contact and the social need that we all have as humans. Mm. And you know, on our walk, on our exercise, sometimes we see some of his nursery friends, and it's really difficult because obviously they can't go near each other. So we're like, oh, hi, bye. Nice to see you. How are you doing? And then we're kind of off, and it must be strange. And when we all come to integrate again, there'll be some issues to deal with, I think, as well as some beautiful moments of us all just hugging each other. I'm going to come and hug you.
The biggest hug. I can't wait. Well, I guess with this podcast, we're trying to bring some light relief for people. And we want to know, well, I want to know anyway, the life of Saran. You know, for many of us, we see celebrities, we see you, as though you've just kind of catapulted to success. And we rarely sort of acknowledge that there's so much hard work in the background that's gone into your ascent. Now, you described in an interview I read that you had a happy working class background. And what I would love to hear is how young Saran, starting out on a little acting journey and your big dreams, how you went from that to landing a role in Coronation Street.
So my name's Sarah Jones, and I'm now Sarah Akers, but Saran came later when I had to choose a name for equity. So I think even as, you know, much like my son, I had a lot of extra energy that I needed to expel, and my teachers kind of cottoned onto that. And I, even though I was quite bright and I was into school, certainly in primary school, I lost concentration. So they decided that perhaps drama would be good for me. And they sent me to this place called Oldham Theatre Workshop. And I attended there from being 10. And it was great because I got to go on weekends. I got to go on evenings. And I met like-minded people that wanted to sing, wanted to dance, wanted to be other characters. And all that extra energy that I had, I really honed at Theatre Workshop. I'll be ever grateful for it. And it's a wonderful place. Lots of people came from there. And I tried lots of other things, as kids do. I'd tried the recorder. I'd tried violin. I'd tried ballroom dancing and some jazz dancing at the dodgy working men's club at the top of our road. And nothing quite stuck. But thanks to my parents, who would come home from work. My mum had two jobs. My dad would come home from his job and he would take me on the bus because we didn't have a car at that time, drop me off at the drama class, come back home on the bus for his tea, and then get back on the bus to come and get me in Oldham while my mum would go to work at her cleaning job at night. So it was a busy time for them. And now as a parent, I really realise how busy and, you know, what a sacrifice that was for them. It was easier when we got a car. But yeah, those moments that I think about my dad, especially in the winter, schlocking back and forth and then coming back for his tea. And but yeah, that was my happy place. And I really found myself there. And then I went off to secondary school. And then life became a bit more difficult and it became more of a sanctuary. Because I was bullied at secondary school and I didn't have a happy time, but I still had Theatre Workshop, which was great. And I was doing shows and we were doing pro-am stuff at Oldham Coliseum. And I was doing like TV shows. There's a show called WAC 90 where I did an impression of Margaret Thatcher with Michaela Strachan. I think she was a Carol Vorderman when I was like 11 or something. So I've been doing it for a long time, really.
Yeah. There's so much of that that I relate to. I had like an imagination that was, you know, I was always the one that was like creating all these games and families and people. And that's when I found acting. I remember going to this little like kids workshop called Through the Wardrobe, which is just, yeah, I've got such happy memories of it. And it was just that sense of escapism that like, as a kid, to be able to go and be whoever you want to be and kind of have that freedom was just so nice. And I also have like really happy memories of drama as a kid. But you did go on to be hugely successful with your, well, you have been hugely successful with your acting career, but your first break, as I mentioned earlier, was on Coronation Street and you burst onto our screens as Karen McDonald. What was this time like for you when you suddenly launched into the spotlight?
So that was 20 years ago. I can't believe that I'm even saying that. That blows my mind that there are some 20-year-olds, you know, are walking on this earth. And that's how long ago, when I, you know, when I put it in people terms, that, oh my goodness, that's how long ago it was. And I think I was working two jobs. So I'd done a lot of TIE, theatre and education. I'd done a lot of one-off episodes of Everything Northern. I'd done lots of pantomimes. I'd been in Corrie before as a different character, actually, Mandy Phillips, who got off with a mechanic and then went to the Chippy and never came back. And when I got Karen McDonald, I think they'd had their eye on me to use me as a different character. And he went, yeah, I was a really normal girl, as you say, very working class background. And I'd been to college and loved my BTEC National Diploma at Higginshaw College, had a great time there. I'd just bought a Filofax and a car because I was working two barmaid jobs. And then Corrie came along and I got a 3-month contract. And my first couple of days, you know, I was suddenly on the set and it was so bizarre. It was just surreal because I knew that then it was going to go on for another 3 months. And then I got another contract for 6 months. And I think what happened, Alice, was, and we can come on to this a bit more, but at the time it was a Lads Maggie, Loaded and Maxim and, oh God, what else was there? You know, those kind of, bikini shop type things.
Yeah.
So it was actually, the first few months was actually about me. I was whisked off to Barbados and put in a bikini. And this is, so I'd been on one holiday to Spain with my mates abroad. So it was like, wow, what is this? And then I got on Stars in Their Eyes because they wanted me to do a celebrity special on Stars in Their Eyes. And then they put me in another magazine with bra and knickers on. And, you know, they would kind of give you a glass of champagne to get you a little loose. And it was kind of, that was more important than the storyline in a way. Mm. And I remember thinking, it was fun at first. And then I thought, this isn't really what I signed up to. Then my storylines became heavier and Karen became much more interesting. And I wanted to stop doing those Lads Mag things. Believe me, there's some dodgy photos out there. I think there's one in a diner where I've got ketchup and mustard squirting at the camera. I don't know.
Well, you sort of fed the narrative at the time that like, this is really going to help your career. You know, if you get into a bikini, oh God, that's really going to elevate your status. That's really going to, you know, push you into new kind of jobs and you know, put you more in the public eye.
If I'm being honest, yeah, I do. I think that, you know, I don't think Coronation Street was alone in that. I think that all of the soaps used their girls in that way. I was never particularly, I didn't go to the gym. I didn't know about good eating habits. I hadn't really thought about my body up until that moment. So I do think that suddenly you're asked to do all those things and it creates the narrative of, oh, if you're good looking or you're sexy. You know, there was the Sexiest Female Awards and all that kind of stuff at the Soap Awards. Mm. So, yeah, those seeds were planted in my head really early on, actually, until I became very aware that I was also winning acting awards and I was being used a lot and my character was becoming popular. And then actually the pull of that and the creativity became much more. But thank God that I felt like that because there was no one there, the press office, there was no guardian for new young actors and there was no media training. And I think there should be. I'm not sure that there is, maybe there is now, but it was quite a shock to go from the girl that I was to then this kind of young soap star.
Well, I think as well, it's kind of a sign of the times that like women were just sexualized. That was something that if you were a woman in the public eye, it was kind of expected of you that you would do those sorts of things. And I think, you know, the Me Too movement has a lot to be thanked for in terms of, you know, women recognizing that they don't have to take their clothes off to be successful, and that, you know, that kind of casting room couch environment did exist. And, you know, a lot of women weren't believed in that sense. And I'm not saying that happened to you, but I think, you know, even just that you felt as though you had to do those shoots and do those things to somehow elevate your career just makes me so, so sad. You didn't have any hang-ups about your body before then, but as soon as someone thrusts the camera on you and starts making your body the focus rather than your talent, it's easy to see how you can start to then feel maybe a little bit more self-conscious about things and be a bit more aware about things.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I hung around with a lot of the Hollyoaks girls, and they were kind of, a lot of them were employed for their beauty. I mean, a lot of them were talented as well, but they were doing a lot of shoots and they had their own calendar and stuff. And I was hanging around with one of my best friends, Michaela Dodd, was in Hollyoaks, and we used to hook up a lot around that time. So yeah, I think that it definitely seeped into my consciousness. I mean, I still think it does in places, and I think we've come a long, long way, but I still think we have to be aware. And, you know, people like you and other podcasts that I listen to are really changing the way for young girls. But yeah, when I think about it, it really must have had an impact on someone who never really thought about that kind of stuff. Because I joined a gym with Mickey, and I lost a lot of weight, actually. Had my hair cut short, and I think I was aiming for Victoria Beckham when she had her hair chopped off. I was kind of like Karen McDonald, went a bit posh at one point and started working in a furniture factory and had an affair. And that coincided with me going to the gym. And then eventually I just felt like I wanted to get out. I felt like my storylines were repeating, and I loved working with Simon Gregson, and he's so brilliant and so wonderful with comedy. And I learned so much at Corrie, and I did have the best time. So I don't want to darken my memories, because I met some wonderful people that are still my friends now. But I did feel like I needed to move on, and I realized that it wasn't what I got into acting for, because I'd been doing it since I was 8. I never wanted to just be in a soap forever. So when I was 24, I decided to leave.
And that must have been really scary, because I know that we sort of have this kind of perception of soap stars that they might leave for a little bit, but they always seem to come back. They're just, you know, some characters never seem to die. Did you feel as though when you were leaving, you were like, this is it, this is final, I'm not going to go back? And if that was the case, what was your idea of where you wanted to then go?
I mean, I don't blame a lot of people for kind of taking a break and then going back. It's a steady job. It's regular income. And, you know, if people have families, or, you know, they've bought a house, and, it, you know, it's a scary world out there for actors. And, you know, a lot of my actors struggle a lot, and writer friends, you know, my husband's a writer, and, you know, he has real big lulls. It's really hard. So I think I was determined that I felt like I could go and teach, because I'd been teaching. So I felt like if I didn't make it, I would then go and teach rather than go and repeat myself back at Corrie. And I would live a life that suited those means. And I really believed in that. I wanted to do theatre because I missed it, because I grew up on theatre. And it just so happened, I mean, you know, there was a period where for 3 or 4 years where I did some dodgy, dodgy shows because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was young. I was so young. And as we've just talked about, I was getting out of this place of not knowing who I was. I kind of found myself at Corrie, and then I left, and then suddenly I didn't have my university mates type thing. And I was like, oh, no one's taking me to these auditions, and no one's picking me up to take me to the Soap Awards. And oh, how do I manage myself? Like a baby, really. I was like a soap baby. I had to learn how to kind of live again, you know, because I didn't have that support system.
And that's actually going to lead me on to asking you about that was I was thinking about, you know, you mentioned before you had some friends around you. You've mentioned that your mum and dad were around in the early days kind of thing. But one of the things that I think is really crucial to keeping someone in a positive state is having a good support network. And we know that many, many actors can live a very lonely existence, you know, going from one job to the next. And on leaving the soap, did you find that you had good people around you to support you? And, you know, has a support network always been something that you've strived to maintain?
I think I've got friends from, you know, when I was really young, from theatre workshop. I kept lots of friends from Corrie, some school friends. So, you know, those are the people that you are rooted in. And my mum and dad, my mum's passed away now, but they always believed in me. They always supported me. I could call them at any time and did often, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning to tell them who I was with. And I remember getting Stephen Gately to sing to my mum. I was with Keith Duffy and I was like, "Mum, I'm with Boyzone. They want to sing to you." And she was like, "It's 3 o'clock in the morning." I'm like, "I know." And then, you know, they just like celebrated all that stuff. But it was difficult. It was a very different time than Alice. In Manchester, Manchester United and Corrie were the kind of only things that were big. And so the press hounded us a lot. We were followed a lot. We had press outside our houses. So all that was a bit difficult to kind of shake off, you know, shake off the soap star image. And I think it's not so much now, but at the time, breaking into drama from being a soap star was very difficult. So there was an awful lot of rejections. So yeah, support systems are beautiful and really, yeah, can change a person's life, I think. And I did have it. I definitely did have it. But then there was the things that people don't understand, which is the being followed and the being famous. And, you know, a lot of people loved Karen McDonald, and they, because she was really loud and rough, people thought I was really loud and rough. And they were kind of disappointed when I had a slightly better accent and I was a bit shy. Like, oh God, you're not like her. But yeah, I've had a lot of ups and downs, I think, and I've lived on my own. Yeah. I've had a lot of boyfriends that didn't work out, like any young woman trying to find who she was, I think.
I want to know about kind of, you said it was difficult to break from soap to drama, and that was obviously your ambition, and to do stage as well. But what were the roles that you were most attracted to? You know, we've seen you play quite a lot of characters who all had difficult baggage in various different ways. And I wondered if that was a conscious choice or if those were roles that you just kind of fell into. What kind of roles really started to suit you as you sort of started to find yourself as an actress, I guess? What were you most attracted to?
Well, I was attracted to musical theatre and comedy, really. That's what gives me joy. And I know you did it. You did musical theatre too. It really does bring joy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the most joyful thing in the world.
Yeah, like that singing and dancing and expressing yourself in that way and having fun. But for some reason, I tried a few roles like that, and there must have just been a darker side to me that I did a show called Harley Street, which was okay. And then I did something called Strictly Confidential, which was a Kay Miller show. And that was, I don't think I knew what I wanted out of that, really. It was, I didn't know what the tone was. And it wasn't until I did a show for Sally Wainwright, actually, called Unforgiven. That was about a woman who was leaving prison, and still one of my favourite jobs. Beautifully written.
So good.
I mean, Sally's writing is fantastic, but the character, it allowed me to really play into my strengths, which was, I wanted to immerse myself in a role and kind of become unrecognizable. And I think that was the first time I felt like I had, like I felt, really felt like the character. Every day I'd go on set and I was Ruth. And then that was kind of picked up from the South Bank Awards. And they nominated me for a breakthrough artist. And, you know, this is years after I'd been in the public eye, and I was like, oh, wow, now they're saying I'm breaking through. How interesting. But that's when I started to find myself. And I still think about that time and think, oh, so when you finally find who you are and how you can celebrate your talents and connect with an audience, that's when you are truly breaking through to people. And I did then go on to quite a few dark parts, dark roles. Scott and Bailey had light moments in it, and I and it's still got a really great fan base. And I loved that show. We did 5 years, and myself and Leslie and Amelia and Sally kicked that off as well.
I love Scott and Bailey. Me and my mum used to watch it together.
Rachel Bailey was such a brilliant character. Mm. And, you know, I loved going back every year to that. And that was an original idea from myself and my good friend Sally Lindsay. Mm. And she ended up playing my sister because she was pregnant with her twins, so she couldn't play Janet. So obviously we got the brilliant Leslie Sharp. And yeah, that was a great time. And then by season five, I ended up exec producing on it. So I really got a lot out of that job. And that's when I started to love producing.
I think with that as well, it's interesting that you've recognized elements from each of those and been able to take those into the next job. But I think what was really interesting was what you said about Unforgiven, that it was the first time that you felt, oh, I've really, really gotten into a role. And I think that just shows the growth of you as an actress, as a person, you know, having done loads of amazing jobs before that. But it's only when in ourselves, when we recognize that feeling, that we can start to say, oh, you know what, I'm actually okay at this. I'm doing all right.
Yeah. And I think it was a time in my life where my mum had got quite sick. So my mum had breast cancer in her early 40s. And then she had a slight breakdown and she had to go on antidepressants, and she'd stopped work around that time. And we were all pretty worried about her. There was a lot of stuff brought into focus around that time. And so it was just probably a section of my life where I needed to focus more, and perhaps I hadn't focused before that. I think I was taking roles because I was grateful that people were offering them to me, and I was so glad that, you know, oh my God, you've given me a lead role, but I'm a soap star. Should I be doing this? And there's a time when you have to stop being so grateful for just being let into the room and actually go, no, I'm worth this. You can invite me into the room and I will show you what I can do, and that you'll be pleased that you invited me in. And then I'll be grateful for the creativity that we've put into it together, rather than just being pleased that, you know, like a people, you know, people pleaser. There's a time when you have to just move on from that. And I think that was the time that I did that.
I just got goosebumps listening to that. It's like, yes, you are worth it.
Aww.
And I think, yeah, it takes time for you to find that inner confidence. I know with myself, that sense of imposter syndrome is a recurring theme in my life, where I go for jobs or I go for things and I'm like, I don't deserve this. What am I doing here? Oh my God. And then sometimes you have moments where you're like, hang on a second, I've done all of these things and I deserve my spot, you know, and whatever on this thing, just as much as anyone else. And yeah, I think, you know, it's a constant battle for some people, but it's amazing that you started to recognize your worth and your value in that industry, and that you really took ownership of that. And I think that's such an empowering thing that, you know, we all strive for, I guess, in life.
If you have confidence in yourself and you believe in yourself, and really it's a recipe that, you know, I read often on your Instagram as well. People see it and then they just trust you to bring the goods. And then because they trust you to bring the goods, it gives you more confidence. And that's where the magic happens, because everyone's starting to engage properly. I mean, don't get me wrong, like you as well, I have days where I'm like, what am I doing? How am I even here? But if you didn't have those days, then you'd be a right arsehole, I think.
Exactly. No, I agree. Now, Dr. Foster was one of the best bits of TV over the last 10 years, and you won a BAFTA for your role. Talking about seeing your value and taking ownership of your talent, that was a role that I thought you just shone like nothing else in. It was so special to watch and such a powerful piece of drama. What was it about Gemma Foster, the character that you played, that you were able to connect with and therefore play her so convincingly?
I think by that point, I'd started writing myself. I'd started producing. I was really picking my projects. I'd done a lot of more theatre, so I was taking time out and being quite choosy. I changed agents after Corrie. So, you know, we had really worked together on what kind of things we'd wanted to do. And Dr. Foster came along, and the script written by Mike Bartlett, who's predominantly a theatre writer, seemed so different. It was at the time when family projects, like stories about family or relationships, weren't very popular. Everything was kind of like crime dramas and big aesthetics or bigger pieces. So this small piece just about these two people and written by a theatre writer seemed so on TV, yet it was also very heightened. So the challenge was, how do I make this story ping? And also the challenge for Mike and the producers, because it was essentially just about a guy who had an affair. And, you know, and then that spanned through all the episodes. But what it did was it spoke to me in a way that I knew it would speak to a lot of other people. People either have a fear of being left, or a fear of being cheated on, or have been cheated on, or know a story, or rely so much on their relationship and their home and their families to bring them happiness, that delving into a world where those things were blown apart was going to affect me and also the people that watched it. And I just believed that we could do that in a really interesting way. And Mike had this idea that he wanted to play it like Medea. So the whole point was that it was going to be this heightened roller coaster of a show. And it was just so different. And then after that, family dramas and dramas about relationships became really popular, because I think it just spoke to people and they knew it. They liked thrillers and they liked big cop stories, but they couldn't relate to them in the way that they could Gemma Foster.
She was just such an amazing character that I think all of us could sort of have some element of being able to relate to. And I just think that that whole storyline, you're so right. Some of it was very sort of normal. You know, we know affairs happen. What's so special about this one? But at the same time, some of it was so heightened that you were on the edge of your seat thinking, oh my God. And I just loved that kind of juxtaposition of those two things. I think it was, yeah, it was amazing.
She did all the things that like you would want to do if you found out that your husband was cheating with a younger woman. She didn't just think it, she did it. And I think that was the joy of the show as well. And, you know, she was bloody mental. Yeah. As well as being gorgeous and, you know, and heartbreaking, because her husband had an affair and she believed in this marriage. She was also quite mental, and people do love that. So however Mike did it, it really spoke to people. And then to get a BAFTA at the end of it, I just had a baby as well. So I was sat at home with an 8-week-old baby and a BAFTA, and I was like, wow, this is a cool moment.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about that actually, because I think often in life, and the weird thing about being in the public eye is that sometimes our best moments, you know, where you are, you know, in the top TV programs and you're winning the BAFTAs and you're doing all the things that people think, wow, isn't she doing amazing, can actually sometimes in reality be our worst and be some of the times when we actually have the darkest or most difficult times. I've definitely experienced that. And I wondered if there was ever times where you'd ever felt like this, as though you sort of have to keep up a pretense that everything's really wonderful and that you're doing really well and you're being really successful, when actually, you know, inside you might be like, hang on a second, oh, I don't feel quite right about this, or just have, you know, moments where you're actually in a state of a bit of darkness, but you can't sort of let that on.
Well, I think that after I finished filming Dr. Foster, I'd had my child and my mum passed away. So I'd finished filming Dr. Foster 2 and my mum passed away and I had my my baby. And around that time, exactly, what should have been like a high, a real high, I'd won a BAFTA, I was getting invited to, you know, bigger and better doors were opening and more opportunities were happening. I was married. Lots of changes had happened. And I'd gone back to work not long after I'd had my baby to a show where I was then working 14-hour days and trying to have my baby on set. And I'd struggled breastfeeding. And then we had to send my little one to nursery and that didn't really work out. And there was a lot of stuff going on. And I was listening to a podcast this morning, actually, on my run, about who you think you should be and who you want the public to think you are, who you want your friends to think you are. And it's a really difficult one to shake all that off and just be who you are. And I don't think I was doing that at all at that time. Mm-hmm. I think I was really, really putting a face on. And well, as you know, when we met, things kind of took a turn for the worst after all that. So it was probably bubbling up from then, actually.
Yeah. Who did you think people wanted you to be?
I think maybe I've always had you know, the chip on my shoulder of having to prove myself again, because once you find yourself and once you, like what I said before, of like, I started to have the confidence, then when you get into the bigger, better rooms, or you get the BAFTA, or you get more opportunities, and, you know, more eyes are on you, and you're thrust further into the public eye, I think then more pressure comes on. So then you have to fight through that bit to then decide who you are again and have the confidence again at the next level. Mm. And as well as being a young mom, well, not so young, actually. They called me a geriatric mom at the time, so in my late 30s. And a wife, you know, me and my husband met and we were engaged after 5 months and married after 9. So that's a whirlwind as well on top of everything. Yeah, and then to have my mom, who I rang 3 times a day, pass away. Mm. And that kind of, you know, split our family up, because my mom was kind of central to the family and I didn't see everybody as much. I mean, we're still all very close as we can be, but I live in London now and they're all north. Mm. So I guess I just needed everyone to think that I was just coping and I was a great mom and still being the most productive actress I could be, and producer, and, you know, everything. I was trying to be everything.
Yeah. When we met, you were definitely doing that. You know, you were about to embark on filming Gentleman Jack. You were also doing a play in the West End every night, of which the subject matter was incredibly dark. You know, I started to sense that something maybe wasn't quite right. And, you know, we had some moments together where I, you know, I desperately wanted to support you, but I didn't quite know how. And I was, you know, still in my own sort of place as well 2 years ago. And I wondered if maybe you could explain in your own words what sort of happened during that period.
So Gentleman Jack was a project I really wanted to do. And when I heard that I was going to be doing that, I had to put certain things in place. So I knew I was going to be living in Yorkshire for 7 months of the year. And if it was successful, I'd be doing that again, which hopefully after lockdown and we get back to work, I will be going to Yorkshire. So there was big changes kind of afoot anyway, which makes you, you know, with a young child and, you know, a life you've already set up, you're like, okay, right, this is going to be what we're going to be doing for the next few years, hopefully. And I came to you. So it was a play, Brian Lavery's play called Frozen. It was in the West End. It was at the Haymarket Theatre. I'd already played there and loved the Haymarket. Smack bang in the West End. I actually had a choice of what play to do, which still blows my mind that I chose Brian's play. I mean, it's brilliant, but I always wanted to do a musical and it was so far away from what I thought I wanted to do, because it was about a paedophile who killed my daughter, and the premise is that I get to meet him and we have a conversation about forgiveness, and it's all monologues. So it's just it was a very lonely play in the fact that I get to speak to just the audience, and then I have one scene with the psychiatrist and one scene with the murderer. So I was doing that. I was also prepping for Gentleman Jack, and I didn't know how strong I'd have to be. I wanted to change my body to be slightly more masculine around the shoulders. I didn't know if there was going to be nudity. So I came to you to say, let's work on getting me leaner and slightly more muscular, because I was playing a woman who is out every day working with her hands, walking everywhere. So I knew there was a certain look I wanted to go for. However, I was getting up in the morning to play with my son really early, and then I'd go to rehearsals, get the tube over to rehearsals across the other side of town, do a full day of rehearsals, just me and the director, because it was just monologues, so it was just me and him. My character cried a lot. Well, you saw the play. So my character cried a lot and was in trauma throughout the whole piece. Then I'd get home and I'd do a couple of French lessons, and I'd come and see you at the gym 3 times a week. Mm-hmm. And I was just overstretching myself. I was going to meet Sally to do rehearsals. We were working on the text. I was having to really go through all of the Ann Lister diaries, because it's based on a real woman who left 5 million words of a diary. So I was having to go through all these diaries to really embed the character, so that when I'd finished the play, I could then go off with the knowledge that I knew what I was doing. And you know, I would come to you and I cried on a running machine once. So no, it was the rowing machine. I remember it was the rowing machine. Yeah. It was because I was so tired and I was trying to say to you, I need to fit this in because I want to be strong, but I'm doing too much. And at the time, I guess you had a different attitude as well. You took me into the yoga studio, I remember, and said, right, let's just sit down and calm down and let's see what's wrong kind of underneath. You said to me, you don't have to train today. And I was like, no, but I do have to train today. And it was that not being able to let go of anything.
Yeah.
And I guess people didn't understand what I was going through, because what I wasn't saying as well is, I don't think I'm being the best mother. And also I'm really sad that my mom died and I'm living this fucking trauma every night on stage that's really messing me up and I'm just knackered. And then I had a collapse because I wasn't listening to my body. I had hallucinations, which are called episodes, where I was started to see things because my body was shutting down. I'd done 90 shows. There were big groups of people coming to the show after to see me, and I had to stop them. So I was starting to say, could you come see me before the show for a cup of tea? Because I was so tired. And the paps were hanging outside the theatre, taking photos of me leaving every night, which was really doing my head in. Because I was like, I'm not interesting. Go away. I'm just literally want to get in my car. And the pressure got to me until I collapsed in front of an audience of, I think it holds 1,500, 2,000, and collapsed on stage in front of everyone. Because I couldn't see. My vision had gone. It was really scary. That's kind of how we met.
It is. And like, I think, you know, you saying this is just the most incredibly brave thing. And I think often when we are going through something or we're experiencing something, it is so incredibly difficult to verbalize what we're feeling and to even be able to articulate, because often, and from what I felt like with you, you didn't even quite know what was going on. You know, sometimes our mind is doing one thing and we are trying to play catch up and discover what it is that it's trying to tell us or do. And it can be the most difficult and confusing thing. And actually only in going through something, having to then deal with those issues and then be able to look back, are you able to sort of recognize what was going on? And I think, you know, one of the things that you have spoken about is how you saw a psychologist. And I wondered if you could talk about, you know, how something that we see as being, you know, oh God, she's gone to see a psychologist, was actually a really positive thing for you.
Yeah. I mean, I was warned a couple of times before my collapse, not to carry on the show, but I was getting letters from people saying, we're traveling from all over the country to come and see you. You're my favorite actress. We're seeing the show again. It was so brilliant. And my poster was right up in the middle of the West End and I kept looking at it thinking, oh God, I've got all, these people are coming to see me. I have to carry on. And I wasn't listening to myself. So when the collapse finally happened, yes, I was referred. And even then, it was this quite a scary moment, actually. I did like an hour and a half chat about how I was feeling and where I was at mentally. And I'm really good at pretending that I'm okay. I remember the doctor saying this, that there are some big moments in my life, like my mum passing away, or, you know, things that have happened to me that I kind of casually talk about, but actually there's a lot of stuff deeper going on that I haven't dealt with. And I think the show and the tiredness had just brought everything to the fore, because what I tend to do, Alice, is even this morning, because I was nervous about doing the podcast, I did a million things, because I think that's how I put off being nervous. So the anxiety comes out in this mania where I have to do loads of stuff, because then it'll all go away, or I'll be busy myself so much that I won't have to think about it. And I did that on this enormous scale. And I was offered medication. And at the time I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to go to therapy and figure out what this, you know, how this has happened. It was in the newspapers at the time. I never spoke about it. I only did an interview with Vogue after Gentleman Jack, actually, to kind of say what had gone on, because I was embarrassed, and the paper got it, you know, all out of proportion. Even doing this podcast, I know that I'm giving them headlines, which is why I find it so, for any person in the public eye trying to talk about themselves, you know, you're creating headlines. And actually, this, I just think, fuck it for now. This is my truth.
The one thing I'd say is, in you doing this, there may be headlines, and you know, it is frustrating, and I'm sure it's difficult that you can't just talk about stuff without getting that. But on the flip side of that, I know that you talking about this will help so many people who feel the pressure that you felt to be everything to everyone and lose themselves at the same time. You know, I can't imagine what it must be like for you to suddenly, you know, your every move is kind of being watched, and you feel as though if you put a foot wrong, or if you say something that's maybe a little bit off from what you're usually doing, that suddenly that's going to be in the paper. But at the same time, there are people out there who love you and who, in hearing your experience, will take so much comfort from you showing that level of vulnerability.
Yeah, and I hope it does, because I guess at the time as well, why I didn't take the medication, this is crazy when I think back, is because anxiety and depression had become quite fashionable. And I say that in a way of suddenly everyone was talking about it. And rather than me embracing that and thinking, okay, well, everyone's talking about it, it's okay, take the medication, go to therapy, and, you know, start to get better, I thought, I don't want to be another person that's got this fashionable thing. I don't want to be, I kind of kicked back against it. And so what happened was I went to therapy, I filmed the whole of Gentleman Jack, I got through, and then I had another collapse after filming Gentleman Jack, and I went back to the doctors and I took the medication, and I did it for a year, and then came off, you know, when I felt like the time was right. And because by that point I was not coping at all, I wasn't sleeping, which is, as we all know, is just the worst thing. But Anne Lister really saved me as well, because she is so positive, and playing that character every day gave me a reason to get up and just push through. And the joy of playing that character really, you know, sustained me. And then, of course, when I stopped playing that character, then I had to deal with the fallout again. And that's when my husband and I said, okay, let's take this medication and really take some time off to get better. And that's what I did. And I'm so glad I did. And you know, I just want to say to anyone else in this position, or who feels like, I mean, now especially, now everyone knows what anxiety is because of being in lockdown and because of the unknown. I think everyone can understand it a bit more. But to think that I thought, oh, I don't want to be another person that's got this, it's just crazy. You have to listen to yourself. You have to listen to your body and your mind and take care of yourself, because no one else is going to.
But also, no matter how, you know, there are a lot of people talking about anxiety and depression, that doesn't mean that your experience of it isn't any less valid. I think that's really, really important. Everyone's experience is different, and everyone's experience is valid.
Yeah. And that, I think that's the thing, is your anxiety and my anxiety are going to be different. And it's going to show itself in different ways. And that's why it's been hard for people to connect with it before now, I think, because you can't just say it's this symptom. It's very different for different people. And finding a balance is really, really hard, especially with social media and the pressure of, you know, to do everything really well. It's brave when you take a step back and try and take stock. And this is a great time to be doing that now, actually.
That's what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, the last time we saw each other before recently, I didn't see you for a very, very long time, nor did I hear from you. And, you know, like that whole time in the back of my head, I was thinking, I hope Saran's okay. I hope Saran's okay. And I remember when I got this message from you to say, let's catch up, you know, and I remember I came to meet you at BAFTA, and you were a different energy. You know, you had this inner light that maybe had gone out a little bit when I saw you before. And you had to do the year off. You came off social media as well, if I'm right in saying.
I did, yeah.
Do you feel as though that was actually probably one of your bravest steps was, you know, when your career is going in one direction and everything's going up, 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 to then have to say, hang on a second, this is all great, but I'm not okay. So I'm actually going to take a step back and have some time off. Do you feel like that was one of your maybe most difficult, but sort of bravest or boldest decisions?
I think that I had no other choice. and I wish that it didn't get to that. I wish it hadn't have got to that point. And I hope it doesn't get to that point for so many people out there, because I scared myself with what happened, those kind of two moments in time where I, you know, had real, like I just wasn't coping. So,
and it was physical symptoms as well. And that's when it becomes terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah. And so there was just no choice, and I had to get better. And I think that now I will never let it get to a point where my body shuts down, or, you know, I get so anxious that I feel like I can't do stuff, because I need to learn now that those two moments in my life were, they were just, I never want to go back there. So yeah, I think I've really learned a lot from those times. And, you know, who knows going forward, I feel like I am much more balanced now and able to do a lot more things, and also take a rest, take a break when I need it, because life isn't going anywhere. And it's this thing I like, you know, if someone doesn't want you because you've taken a little break, then, you know, that's fine.
I could not agree with you more. And I think that is so important, is that if you don't instigate change from within an industry, and I think this is something that we spoke about within the acting industry, is if you don't instigate that sense of change where there needs to be that pastoral care and that care for people's well-being above and beyond just how they perform on the job, then I think, you know, nothing will ever change. So you leading the way by saying, I'm going to take a year off and get myself into a better place, and there will be jobs for me when I come back, I think is such an empowering thing. Looking back on time, you know, across your career so far, what do you think are some of the things that you now do, you know, in having taken time out, having had a refocusing, I guess, of your approach to your well-being? What are some of the things that you think you do now that you weren't doing then to protect your mental well-being?
I mean, I still think it's difficult, and a lot of actors in my position will understand this. And in fact, a lot of women, men who have, you know, jobs that take them into 14 hours and physically exhausting. It's difficult because maybe I do a 4 month job, 4 to 7 month job, where I'm the lead in a show. And for those 4 to 7 months, I'll be working 14 hours. And then maybe I'll have a Saturday with my son and husband, and then a Sunday morning. And then I'll either be traveling back to my work, or I'll be learning lines. So I know that I have to look after myself within that bubble. That's still a really hard thing to do. What I now do is, when I don't work, I have to make up for the time that I couldn't look after myself as well as I wanted to. So even though I'll have massages, or I'll do yoga, and I meditate, and I really try to rest on my rest days, even though that's hard with a 4-year-old, I really try to take rest days, and my husband really encourages that. So it's kind of the times when I'm not working that I've learned that I don't have to do a million things. And I really want to, because I've just, my monkey mind, they call it, don't they, where it's just like, oh, you need to do stuff. You haven't been in contact with that person. You haven't seen your friends. I have to slow it down. And I've learned how to do that now.
Yeah, I think, you know, learning to say no is a very difficult thing to do, but so critical to our well-being. You're now a producer as well on a lot of different things, some of the stuff you're working on, and you have a lot of projects in the pipeline. As a producer, do you feel you come into it with the hindsight of, I need to look after my cast members and make sure that their well-being is, you know, really important to the running of the filming and the show?
Yeah, and I really try and look after young cast members as well. I really try to lead the way as a lead actress within the show. I think you set the tone. So I try to look after the cast. I try to look after the crew and make sure that everyone's been treated well. Mm. And yeah, as a producer, we've bought the rights to Jane Couch's book, and we're taking our time on it. We're in development at the moment, but Jane has to have care because it's her story. So we're taking that into account much more than I guess I would have done having not gone through, you know, what I've been through. It just gives you a duty of care of other people that you really invest in, I think. Yeah. And I think it's so important to do.
What are some of your non-negotiables now when it comes to keeping yourself healthy? And I know healthy is different to everyone, but in your version of what a healthy life looks like to you, what are some of the things that are your non-negotiables?
I think that family time for me is the most important thing, because I'm away so much that our weekends are just for us. And I don't mean like the three of us just have to be together, but, you know, we can go and see our friends and we can have dinner and we can go to, you know, on play dates and stuff. But we have to be together and anchored, because those are the times when I feel most at peace and happiest, when I'm just being Jesse from Toy Story, or, you know, he's been Buzz Lightyear, or I'm Minnie Mouse, or whatever. And my husband and I are sat on the sofa and reconnecting. A Sunday lunch has become really important, you know, eating together when you don't get a chance to eat together. Mm. My son has just started to love gravy, and that's very important because I'm Northern. so this makes me really happy. And yeah, I think connecting with my family, my dad, and Lawrence connecting with his family is really important. And then us jumping in bed early at least three times a week. And even if we've, you know, a separate bed maybe, because there's stigma against that. But if we are not sleeping or we are just tired, I need a good night's sleep and I want to go to bed at 9 o'clock and I don't want to put my earplugs in, or I don't need to be disturbed by snores, then that's okay too, to say, I just need my space. And yoga. Yoga's my other huge thing. A workout is great, but yoga is for my mind too. So that is non-negotiable. Every day I do yoga.
Now, what you've spoken about today, I think there's a lot of it that's relatable. And I wondered what you would say to the person out there who's probably listening, who, you know, wants to do it all. They want to be a great mom, a great wife. They want to exercise. They want to do yoga. They want to meditate and have a high-flying job and be a great friend and be a great family member, you know, and they're trying to juggle all of those kind of balls constantly. What would you say to her or him, having experienced that feeling of overwhelm at trying to do all of those things?
I'd say, how do you feel? Like, genuinely, how do you feel? Because if you don't feel strong or happy, or you don't feel motivated in the right way, then there's something wrong, because that means that you need to fix something or change something, even if it's just for a couple of days till you get yourself back on track. But just tuning into how you feel is really important. And also, you don't have to be everything. You just don't. And it's better to be a really good something some of the time than grasping at trying to be everything. And gosh, you know, just trying to be yourself. It's really difficult. Alice, you know this, especially in the public eye, but just for anybody, just who are you and what does that really mean? Mm. You know, I'm still answering that, but I think those are the two things. How do you feel and who are you inside? You just don't have to be everything.
Yeah. Now, moving on to exciting projects that are coming up. You mentioned one that you're working on, but can you tell us about anything that you're really excited about working on over the next few months or years?
Yeah. So I had to stop Vigil, which is a brilliant project from BBC, which is a cop show partly set on a submarine. Rose Leslie also stars in that, and Sean Evans. And then Gentleman Jack 2. So those are the two big things that after the lockdown, we're just talking about how we're going to finish one project and then get onto the other. Mm. The Jane Couch project that is through our company that we are writing, producing, developing. And we have just bought the rights to another book, which is very exciting. We're just going through the motions of that, and hopefully that'll go into development. And those aren't projects that I'll necessarily be in, but it's just exciting that we've got those things that we're, I can be behind the scenes and develop and really get into that. And then I'm talking to Dominic Savage, who did the I Am series for Channel 4, about doing one of those as well, which is very exciting. I think he's wonderful and a real gentle, kind soul. So who knows when we'll get back to all these things, but that's what the plan is.
Fingers crossed you get to do the I Am, because I think that will be so special. I will look out for that, definitely. Now, at the end of every podcast episode, I ask two questions. And the first one is, what does strength look like to you?
Sometimes getting through the day. I think it can be, on my down days, strength is just getting through the day and knowing that at the end of the day, you did it. It can be as simple as that. And then the other thing is my mum, because she went through an awful lot and her body took an awful lot on, and she still lives and shines within me so brightly that her strength, and she was only 5 foot nothing, this little thing is still so powerful. So
where did you get your height from?
I know that my dad's side of the family, the women are tall on that side of the family.
I'm 5 foot and that's pretty small, but you are really tall. I love that answer. And I think she will be so, so proud of you if she can see what you're up to now. So that is just really, really special. And then my final question for you is, who in your life demonstrates strength the most?
I guess I kind of answered that as in mum. But I'm going to go my husband as well, because he supports me in everything I do. Gosh, I could cry. How weird. Well, not weird, because it's
normal. Truth, but
he's just always there for me, always supporting me, very honest and truthful with his opinions, which I love. Again, I'm Northern, so I like someone being honest with me. Quite brutal at times, but it works. Yeah, he's pretty wonderful.
I love that. And I know that, like, getting through something that you got through is only possible with incredible people to support you around you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Saran, you are just the most special person. I wish I could hug you now, but I can't. But I just want to say thank you so much for being so open and honest, but also just sharing so much. You know, like you said, it's sometimes difficult for you to come out with these things, because there is the sense of where you are in the public eye, and talking about these things has implications. But I just think if we look at it in a positive way, sharing this stuff is so powerful and helps so many. And I'm so, so grateful that you have taken your afternoons to share with us. And yeah, thank you so much.
I'm hugging my computer, and I think we've just got to think fuck them, haven't we?
Like, yeah.
To those. So I'm hugging my computer and thinking fuck them.
Oh, thank you so much. And I will speak to you very soon, I know.
Soon, darling.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Give Me Strength. We appreciate any feedback you can give, so please do rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, and come back next week for another episode. And a big thank you again to our sponsor, Pronamel. With twice daily, regular brushing, Pronamel can help rebuild enamel strength for strong, healthy, white teeth. Buy yours now from your retailer of choice by clicking the link in this episode's description, or through your Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Home. To shop via Alexa, say, "Alexa, open Pronamel toothpaste." To shop via Google Assistant or Home, say, "OK, Google, talk to Pronamel toothpaste." Find out more in this episode's description.